Well, good morning. This will be lesson 11 on covering chapter 11, as well as the chronology of Judges and where it fits in the overall historical picture. And I will finish up with Jephthah and the Ephraimites, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. There's a lot of ground to cover today. Not that that's any different than what we've done any other week, but this week there's an awful lot to cover, and it is my intention to cover it. So I'm not going to offer lots of opportunities to answer what I would consider petty questions anyway. And so when we get to the break point after the chronology, we'll take time to talk about what I've brought forth here. And that may be a good question to ask. What have I brought forth here? There's a lot of information regarding the chronology of Judges. And from what I can tell, most of it's misleading. And I think it's worth covering for about half of a class. And you may ask why, and that's a good question, and we'll get to all those things in a minute. So this whole portion of the class up where the C designation is are my thoughts on the chronology and why you need to know it. And I ask you to trust me in this one thing. I'm not telling you everything there is out there, but I have filtered a fair amount of it, so hopefully I've saved you some distress, because there is an awful lot of material on biblical chronology. All right, so the first question to ask is, what's the fuss? What's the fuss about the chronology of Judges? Why is it even important and worth discussing? I've had a table many weeks throughout the class detailing how we've seen the years of rest and the years of servitude, and how there seems to be chronological remarks with the Judges and how we are to look at those. It seems rather straightforward, but actually it's not. The dating of the book of Judges is quite complicated, and it's not in what I would call the same league as dating, say, the age of the earth or the days of creation or understanding the days of Genesis. I don't think it's quite in that same league, but that doesn't mean it's unimportant. And here's why the book of Judges is important and why it's worth fighting for the right timing. And that is, there are a lot of other events in the Bible that are more important that we don't have good dates for. And if you omit a good date for the book of Judges, you've got a real problem on your hands when it comes to the Exodus. And really, that's what it's all about, is understanding the Exodus. Because we don't have any idea when the Exodus occurred. There isn't enough solid archaeological evidence to have convinced everybody out there that the Exodus took place around such and such a time. And the reason why that gets problematic is that there are some rather specific times that we do know about, and some rather specific numbers given in the Scriptures that give us an opportunity to look back on those dates. So if you miss the epoch of the Judges in a rather significant way, then the time and the place really of the Exodus takes a whole new meaning. And if this is in question, which it is in the minds of many, did God really bring out all these millions of people out of Egypt during the time that the Bible has asserted, and people like Usher historically have inserted that happens? If that really didn't happen, if that was a story made up by the Jews, it really wasn't that many people, the Exodus didn't occur as far back as we think it is, well then what other claims of the Bible can we dismiss with? And how else can we look at the Scriptures and say that those historical narratives are in the area of fable, and they're not true? We can't depend on them. Additionally, the duration of the book of Judges is very important, because by this we see how faithful God has been to His people, sustaining them over a very long time. Now, to give you some worldwide picture of where we're at in terms of time, and to show the contrast with the authority of the dates, the sacking of Troy is generally regarded to have occurred around 1200 BC. And you don't see people arguing about it nearly as much as they'll argue about biblical dates. The Mycenaean, the early Greek cultures in the 14th BC, it's 1400 BC, somewhere in there. But what I've been able to discover, and I may be wrong on this, but I think I'm right, that many modern historians place the role of the Judges to be no later than 1200 BC. and I think I have a real problem with that date. And I think it has to start a good 200 some years earlier than this, and here's where the rub is at. When we get to this time period, we're pushed up against the wall by some claims made by the author of 1 Kings and the existing artifacts that we have to come to a solid date. And so there needs to be some reconciliation that takes place and understanding when the dates occur. Now, one problem we have in researching the chronology of Israel is that there are, I don't know the most charitable way to describe it. It seems to me to be more in the realm of numerology rather than a strict historical chronology. And correct me if I'm wrong, Alan. OSU does not offer a degree in numerology in your department. Is that correct? That's correct. So when we speak of numerology, we're talking about a dark art. And I'll bring to light some of the things that people have said. But you will get a feel for some of that. Even some respected authors come up with some rather interesting ways to address the chronology. All right. So when we talk about the overall duration, when we mention this duration of Judges, certain assumptions have to be acknowledged right from the start. Now, if you look at David's house, which ruled Israel from about 1000 BC to 586 in that general time frame, you're talking about 400 years and some change. It's a long dynasty to have in place. And to see God sustaining the house of David that long is absolutely remarkable. Well, what I'm asserting is that the book of Judges is at least this long, and possibly a bit longer. No one disputes the Davidic dynasty in the history of Israel in terms of its duration, or really its importance. But what import is given to the epic of the Judges? It's often neglected as one of those signal time periods in the history of Israel. And I think it's an important piece of the puzzle to put together. If God sustained his people for barely 200 years, and it was all under the umbrella of chaos, and these people were barbarians, and the place was in a steady downhill decline from the death of Joshua on, well, then you would hope for a minimal time period of the book of Judges. But if, in fact, the book of Judges brings forth something very different to light in what God has done to his people and for his people, well, then you start extending that time period to 400 years, and it makes a big difference. Just think of what's happened in our country between 200 years and 400 years. There's quite a bit of history difference between the two and development of the people. So let's look at 1 Kings. This is the date we're up against. This is our starting point for coming to Judges. And you pick the earlier dates when you're doing chronological work, earlier in reference to us, not earlier in towards point of origins. The reason you do this is you've got more evidence to believe that earlier dates are more accurate than later dates. So we're a whole lot more comfortable that something happened in, say, 900 BC than we can pinpoint something that happened in 1500 BC. So that's the only reason you start there. In 1 Kings 6, we have this account that says, starting in verse 1, "And it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord." So, from here, we have this passage telling us that we have 480 years to work with from the Exodus to the fourth year of Solomon's reign when he began to build the temple. It's safe to assume that it's generally acknowledged that the temple was completed around 960 BC. So the beginning date for the temple construction is in the 966 to 967 range, and 1 Kings 6:38 tells us that it took 7 years to complete. Now, if this sounds tedious, what we're discussing here, it's only going to get worse. So just pay close attention, because I'll give you the framework. This is not a math class, and I don't mean to disparage all the wonderful math teachers, but we got a lot of numbers to work with and not a lot of handouts. All right, so with this in mind, the Exodus should have begun, the children of Israel coming out of the land of Egypt, around 1446. We're just taking 966 and 480. That's simple enough. You have a nice round picture that's somewhere around 1445, 1450. that the children of Israel began the Exodus. Covered that up there. So here is the laborious chart, and it's awfully hard to read, but let me tell you what we've got here. We've got to account from the Exodus, which is about 40 years of wandering. We've got to account for that 40 years, which I've omitted here. There's some question as to whether that 480 includes the time they left Egypt or the time they entered Canaan. So there's a 40-year discrepancy right off the bat. But we have the time of Joshua, the post-Joshua time period, the judges here, Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, all the way down to the new judges. We just covered Jephthah. We'll finish him today. Here are the new ones. We'll finish these today. You've got Samson, Eli, Samuel, Saul, and David before you get to Solomon. So here are numbers that we know. Some of them are far more reliable than other numbers. We have no idea how long Joshua's conquest took. But I put 10 years as a starting number. We don't know how long Joshua and the elders had been dead before the children of Israel fell into disarray, so that's 20 years. These numbers here you're a little more familiar with. We've looked at these in the tables before. They're taken directly out of the book of Judges. With Othniel, we had 40 years of rest under his reign, and we had 8 years of servitude under Cushan Rishathaim. And so Ehud's the same way. I will mention that under Ehud, there are some disagreements whether he actually ruled 80 years or was it 40. What does the text say? But for the sake of argument, let's just go with the 80 number to keep it simple. With Deborah and Barak, 40 years. Gideon, 40. Abimelech, we not under him as a judge, but under his tyranny, we had 3 years. Tola, Jer, Jephthah, and on down the line. So more or less, if you add these up, there's questions regarding the overlapping of dates. Did one judge die on the anniversary of another judge starting? If not, then there might have been some overlap. There might have been some gaps. So averaging all those things out and dismissing them as background noise, you come up with about 530 years during this time period. That's a long, long time. Now, that's just taking 10 years for Joshua and 20 years over here. I don't know how long it was. And we're also a little in the dark about some of these dates regarding Eli, Samson, or Samuel, Saul, and David. We don't have firm numbers there. Obviously, with Saul and David, there's some overlap in their kingship, but we're not quite sure how much of it in the chronologies is considered overlap and how much is not. We'll look at this a little bit later, but Samson, Eli, and Samuel are, use this term broadly, contemporaries. Eli is probably alive in the history that we're covering today. And I don't know exactly when Samuel was born and when Samson would have died, but it's not altogether unthinkable that Eli and Samson knew each other. They were part of the Judges Guild, if you will. So there's this overlap problem that you have. We've got these 530 years, and there's lots of problems already with how you might divvy up something like that. And to get to the 480 that the author of 1 Kings tells us occurred since the children of Israel left the Exodus, or left Egypt. Now, if you have to add 40 years to this, well, then it becomes even more problematic. You're up at 570. So, you know, now you're up to 90 years worth of difference. All right, so why did I mention all this? Well, I mention it for several reasons. If you take the face value of what the book of Judges is saying, it's easy to get to the 480 years. In fact, you got a problem because you've got more than 480 years. You're talking well over 500, close to 600 years, depending on how you add things. Now, the problem can be reconciled by what's called the concurrent rule of the judges. Not all judges ruled in a sequential fashion, that some judges ruled in a concurrent fashion. Now, earlier in this study, I argued that I didn't think that was quite the case with most of the judges, but there were possibilities for some of them. There is, I think, much more evidence for concurrency in the rule of the judges toward the latter end of the book than there is at the opening end of the book, and I'll explain that in just a little bit. Well, let me just, I didn't write this down, but in chapter 13, when we start the period of Samson for the remainder of what we'll take in this class, the the history does not begin in the typical fashion of the judges. It doesn't say, now after the death of so-and-so, then Samson came. You know, we have a little bit more history leading up to Samson's birth rather than starting off with the role. If you'll recall, we had things like after Ehud died, the people did such and such. And you get the idea. I think the writer's trying to communicate some sort of sequencing of the judges there and putting things in their proper place. All right. So I don't want to spend a lot of details on this left half of the chart, but over here, turn over to 1 Samuel 12:11, and I'll show you another problem that we have in dating judges. In 1 Samuel 12:11, I've got three points about this particular verse. And the Lord sent Zerubbabel, Bedan, Jephthah, and Samuel, and delivered you out of the hands of your enemies on every side, and you dwelt in safety. So here we have a mentioning of the high points of the history of Israel and what God has done. Well, who is Bedan? He's not in the book of Judges anywhere, but God raised him up as a judge to deliver the people. Some have argued that Bedan is Samson, although commentators and linguists are not at all convinced that that's exactly the case. We don't know that for sure. If he is Samson, then why is he before Jephthah? You see where the problem comes in? Now we've got this missing judge within the chronicle of the judges. We've got to account for him. How many years did he rule over Israel? How many years did he judge? How much time is involved with him? Another question that's not answered in that list is, what about Eli? God raised up Eli as well, and we don't have his time frame in there. So here's where we come into, if you will, the slippery slope arguments and where it gets difficult. The concurrency option, which is that there were multiple judges, at least more than one, ruling at any one time in Israel, and that there was overlap between them, leads, I think, to dangerous conclusions regarding the overall interval. If you compress the time of all the judges, and you take where they were at geographically and say, well, this judge could have been ruling here and this one down here, and the writer is simply indicating that he wrote about A before he went to B and then he went to C. If you make a worst-case scenario and compress them all to their minimal amount of time given their geography, you're back to the 200-some year range. Well, obviously, that puts us back at odds with the passage in 1 Kings. And yet, if we go with a strict, simple chronology, where we have a whole lot more time than what 1 Kings allows. So we've got ourselves a little bit of a dilemma here that we've got to find some way of reconciling those numbers. And I think we should strenuously resist the urge to maximize the compression of the time frame of the book of Judges. All right. One other point about this chronology is that the book of Judges was not written with a strict chronological account in mind. There are lots of firm numbers involved. There's discussion, honest discussion of numbers and who did what. But the book is not written chronologically in a strictly speaking fashion. If you recall, I made the case that the last five chapters of the book of Judges, the appendix, the two sections of the appendix, actually take place at the beginning of the time of the book of Judges. But the author has a specific point on why he included those incidents and did not include them in a strict chronological fashion. So chronology is not the chief importance to the book of Judges. But that doesn't mean it's not important at all. I want to bring your attention back to chapter 10 for just a moment and look at one example of what can be considered what I'm going to call latent concurrency. It's not explicitly mentioned in the text, but I think there's a point that can be drawn from it. In verse 7, we read, "So the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the people of Ammon." Now, they were oppressed by others. They had gone to serve all these other gods. But here it's mentioned that there were two different people groups that were given supremacy over Israel. Okay. Two enemies are mentioned, but only Jephthah. But Jephthah's only enemy that he fought was the Philistine. He didn't fight, the Ammonites. He didn't fight the Philistines at all. Well, what happened to the Philistines? Well, my suspicion is that during this time, the power of the Philistines was kept in check, in part by the advancement of the Ammonites, who would have been people coming from the eastern side of Israel, and it mentions that they crossed over the Jordan, which would have put them into the western half, if you're going to divide the country that way. And the Philistines would have been coming from the southwest, and I suspect their power was checked by a competing interest. It doesn't mean that they were eliminated, and from what I gather, it doesn't appear that Jephthah bothered to fight those guys. He didn't go down to that section with the western tribes and try to fight. Jephthah appears to be more of an eastern and northern Israeli judge. And furthermore, the next judge, the next three judges that take place, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon, from all accounts, are from the north of Israel. We'll look at their locations earlier. So here you've got a rather significant time of the judges. If you take the last judges there, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon, you've got 25 years plus Jephthah's time, and it looks like that concentration is on the eastern side and on the northern side. We don't hear anything about what's happening in Simeon or in Judah or in Benjamin, or what would have been happening to the remnants of the tribe of Dan and what they were fighting. So I think a reasonable case can be made that there is a departure from a strict chronology, if there was one previously, that now we're looking at, there's a point of division that God is raising up Samson over here and Eli and Samuel to fight against the Philistines, and Jephthah and these other judges were raised to fight and keep the borders under control from the northern aggressors and the eastern aggressors. So you can see that it's a reasonable conjecture that there is some concurrency among the judges. We're done with the history of northern Israel when we conclude it today with the battles. But is that the case for Shamgar, for instance? When he delivered from the Philistines, was he concurrent with others? When you take somebody from the south, what were they doing in other areas? You know, we just don't know exactly. And that's why this chronology becomes very difficult to address. Now, I'll make one other point, and this, I think, lends to the idea that what you really find in studying biblical chronology is not so much answers as you do the power of men's imagination, which is everywhere. And I'm trying to distill some of this, but over on this right-hand side, some have gone through great efforts to claim that these minor judges really are not of interest for the biblical account. It's along the same lines as genealogies. Not all genealogies in the Bible give you a strict account from father to son. Sometimes they skip a generation or so. And the argument made there is that this is what's happening with the book of Judges. That 480 years are just the highlights. That seemed a bit stretched to me, but some of the tables I saw were how people were dividing things, they just omit sections here and come up with their own arbitrary ranking of numbers. So it's there for your mathematical enjoyment to see how people have strained to come up with an answer to reconcile these things. All right. One other piece of internal evidence that I mentioned briefly, but I want to put in this context, and that is in section C here, Jephthah's dates. In chapter 11, verse 26, Jephthah makes his case against the king of Ammon when he says, "When Israel dwelt in Heshbon and its villages, in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities along the banks of the Arnon for 300 years, why did you not recover them from that time?" So he made the case that, look, you've had 300 years in order to make your claim that we had been we had a faulty deed to the title. And I put the chart up when you take the counts of just Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Abimelech, Tola, and Jer, you can come up with 300 years just using the face value of the numbers. However, that does not include the time of Joshua's conquest, and it doesn't include the time after the conquest. So there's some strong evidence that you have to factor in concurrency at some point. And lastly, the idea of the time of Ehud, that he actually had peace in Israel for 80 years, is contested, but that only shifts where you're going to put the other 40. It doesn't really change the problem. So I guess the larger point I'm trying to make about these 480 years, which seems to be pretty clear in the book of Kings, that means the Exodus is around the 1450 mark. Now, somewhere in between there, you've got a whole bunch of judges, and you've got Joshua's conquest, you've got the time after the conquest, which is a specific period mentioned. Could have been 2 years, it could have been 20, who knows. And when you add up all these numbers and look at all these judges, you're not going to have any problem getting 480. Now, how you get 480, I think is left to the imagination of the reader. But I don't think it's a point you can settle. But I think it is a point that can be proven that it doesn't matter how you carve it up, you're going to get at least 480 years. And our number in Kings is safe, and we can rely on the older dates that have traditionally been used for the Exodus. So God really did bring his people out. He really did sustain them for that long. And he really did give this epic of 400 plus years for the judges. And we're okay reconciling the dates given in the Bible. However, you know, wasn't it Truman that said that what he really wanted was a one-handed economist in the White House? Because his economists were always telling him, on the other hand. He said, if I could get a one-handed economist, I'd be in good shape. I'd like to look at Acts 13, 16 to 21. You'll find lots of people who... I want to mention this because this passage has provided ample fodder for the unbelieving antagonist to dispute 1 Kings and the historical account of the Exodus in the time of Judges, because Paul apparently contradicts it, or in their mind, plainly contradicts this particular passage. There's a lot of material written on reconciling these two dates, and I want to equip you today to understand that we do not have a contradiction in the Bible between these dates, and I hope to make the case that this is true. I have two answers for you. The first one I believe to be accurate. The second one I believe to be a good example of the use of men's imagination to a righteous cause. But it's worth mentioning. The Bible, the version of the Bible the congregation uses is the New King James, and I'm going to read the section in 16 to 20 from there, and then I'm going to read it in a few other versions and tell you why there's a problem. In verse 16, then Paul stood up and motioning with his hand said, "Men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen, the God of this people, Israel, chose our fathers and exalted the people when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt, and with an uplifted arm he brought them out of it. Now, for a time of about 40 years, he put up with their ways in the wilderness, and when he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he distributed their land to them by allotment. After that, he gave them judges for about 450 years until Samuel the prophet. And afterward, they asked for a king, so God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. That's the only relevant part we need to read. But you can get the ideas, as I've mentioned, that if you're going to start with 450 years as this whole time period, that's going to contradict the 480 years that you're going to find in the account of 1 Kings. And there are lots of websites dedicated to show that the Bible's not true because of this plain and obvious contradiction. Well, I didn't know how to reconcile it, but here's the answer I found. Let me read it from the American Standard Version, and I'll read verse 19 and 20. And when he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he gave them their land for an inheritance for about 450 years. And after these things, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. Well, now that changes things. One date is well before the other. One date is talking about a time period a long time ago, and another is saying it happened afterwards. New American Standard is very similar. It says, when he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he distributed their land as an inheritance, all of which took about 450 years. After these things, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. The Authorized Version says, and when he had destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he divided their land to them by lot. And after that, he gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet. The NIV says, he overthrew seven nations in Canaan and gave their land to his people as their inheritance. All of this took about 450 years. And, that's probably enough. Well, you can see. Somebody have the ESV? I didn't have a copy of that. Whoa, wow. Logan, read 19 and 20, if you will, from the ESV.
It's similar to the NIV. And after destroying seven nations in the land of Canaan, he gave them their land as an inheritance. All this took about 450 years. And after that, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet.
Yeah, so very similar to the NIV. All right. The differences, I think, between the translations have to do with, and I'm not going to spend any real time on the textual criticisms, but I will spend a little bit of time on the grammar so that the point is at least made. The grammar used in these particular sections, the 450 years versus the 40 years period, there's two sets of types of numbers being used there. The 450 years is in the dative case, while the others are in the accusative case. The American Standard and the New American Standard have it correct. So I had a long talk with Pastor about this. We looked it up, and sure enough, he got me all the rest of the information. Part of it has to do with textual philosophy, but there's no question that if you use the right case and the right grammar, you're going to interpret that 450 years as the period from the patriarchs to the Exodus, not from the Exodus to Samuel. All right, there's one other point I want to make about this that I thought was clever. This rendering has what I would call an air of plausibility to it, but still leaves the reader just a bit uncomfortable. And this doesn't fall in the same category, but just to give you a flavor for what you'll find out there in researching this, I'm quoting one writer. Things get a little more complicated here, but a prayerful stage-by-stage study will reveal what I am trying to communicate. These are the secret things of God. Now, when someone's trying to prove the authority of the Scripture by declaring unto you that he found the secret things of God, run for the hills. Run for the hills. Now, Fawcett, who is a well-known Reformed commentator, he cites a work by Pember called The Great Prophecies. I went through the work. I couldn't find where he found it, but I'll trust it's there. He uses a different kind of explanation in trying to reconcile Paul's numbers with that of 1 Kings. And the distinction he uses is that between ordinary years and mystical years. The ordinary years are those you would find on a calendar, and the mystical years are the kinds that you would not find because you are, those were the years under bondage. And God didn't count those in the covenantal calendar, if you will. And I just wrote the numbers down. If you start off up here, you got wilderness time and some judges, you come up with 573 years in their handy little chart. But if you take away all the years that they were under bondage under these principal guys, you come up with 480 years. Now, what I want to applaud their zeal to prove the authority of the Scriptures can be relied upon. I think that's the most charitable thing. But one obvious problem with this is, what about the years they were under bondage that the Scripture doesn't even bother to record? Well, surely those were part of the mystical years as well, and you would think they would deserve to be counted. Shamgar doesn't even have a year given as to how long. So what do you do with his time period? Were they mystical judges altogether? You know, you've got a problem, and I applaud their zeal in wanting to bring this to a firm end so that our trust would not be set upon by bitter antagonists of the Scriptures. All right, so conclusions. It's at hand. I'm done with the chronology. Conclusions. There are no contradictions in the Bible. There are no contradictions in the Bible. Let's be clear about that. But not every incident contained in the Scriptures gives us every piece of information we'd like to know. You're just not going to find everything you want to know. Nevertheless, the dates given are real. Many of them point to things being very, very specific, and they speak to actual events. These judges were real people. Even though we don't have Bedan in the list of the book of Judges, he's nonetheless mentioned somewhere else. Just because we have trouble coming up with a way to reconcile the numbers doesn't mean that those numbers aren't real or that they are unreconcilable. They can be reconciled. Just because you can't do it doesn't mean it can't be done. Just because somebody else to date hasn't done it, and possibly no one ever will, doesn't mean that there isn't a reconciliation there. So I think I've made the case that there's plenty of time for the period of Judges to be taken in its simplest literal fashion, and we don't have a history written in such a way as to bring that reconciliation to the accountant's fine pen that we would typically like to. So I'm going to leave the case rest there, and we've got enough time for a few questions, and then we'll finish chapter 11. I don't know if that was clear or whether I really muddied the waters for the last 40 minutes or whatever.
Well, one of the things is, people assume, okay, we don't have the fact, okay, I don't see how it works, so it doesn't work. And that's the only situation it's applied to. You know, the backup evolution, they come up with the vestigial organs that supposedly we no longer use because we use them back in the past. And then there used to be like over 150 of these, and now the number slowly been reduced because they found out, oh, it does have a function. We just didn't know what it did.
Yeah. Any other questions on the chronology? Okay, good. All right, well, let's pick it up in Judges chapter 12. I wrote 11 there, but we're in chapter 12. Then the men of Ephraim, starting in verse 1, gathered together. Remember, Jephthah is judge. Gathered together, crossed over toward Zaphon. Let me put my map up here so you can see where we're at. They crossed over toward Zaphon and said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over to fight against the people of Ammon and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you with fire." And Jephthah said to them, "My people and I were in a great struggle with the people of Ammon. And when I called you, you did not deliver me out of their hands. So when I saw them, you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and crossed over against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me?" Well, Ephraim is back in the news again because they're picking a fight with another judge. Who can remember the last judge they decided to fight with? Yeah, that's right, Gideon. They fought with Gideon. The last time they had a fight with the judge, Gideon was able to talk him into being at peace, but Jephthah apparently realizes he's not able to do that. This Zaphon right here is on the eastern side of the Jordan, just above the river Jabbok that's been in the news in recent weeks in our study. So the Ephraimites allege that Jephthah did not call them to fight, while Jephthah insists that he did. And either they didn't come or were unable to deliver. Somebody's lying. I suspect it's probably the Ephraimites. Jephthah also mentions that there were others in the fight beside himself. He says, "My people and I." And he had all of Gilead behind him. So it's clear that Jephthah was not trying to fight as a single individual, that he had other people and involved, and he decided that for whatever reason these Ephraimites weren't going to come or were unable to man up. And Jephthah, he can't fathom why these guys want to pick this fight. He reminds them that it was Jehovah who delivered the Ammonites into his hands. And I think by this he's saying, don't forget, that makes me judge and not you. He delivered me in these hands. So why is it again you want to pick a fight with me? But apparently they turn a deaf ear to him. In verse 4, "Now Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, 'You Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim, among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites.' The Gileadites seized the fords of the Jordan before the Ephraimites arrived. And when any Ephraimite who escaped said, 'Let me cross over,' the men of Gilead would say to him, 'Are you an Ephraimite?' If he said, 'No,' then they would say to him, 'Then say Shibboleth.' And he would say, 'Sibboleth,' for he could not pronounce it right. Then they would take him and kill him at the fords of the Jordan. There fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites." What a bizarre portion of Scripture. It would seem that the Ephraimites needed to be punished. And Jephthah, acting as a judge, engages the Ephraimites. And he ends up slaughtering 42,000 of Israel. It's a great slaughter. It would also appear that the Ephraimites... It took me a while to see this, and I hope it's clear for you, that that the Ephraimites made this fight personal with Jephthah by telling the Gileadites that they were fugitives of Ephraim. You guys on the east side of the river, you're not even really Israel. You're fugitives from Ephraim. We're the big dog in Israel. And I think this was meant to be a personal slight against not only the Gileadites, the eastern tribes there, but also it was a double slight against Jephthah himself because he was a fugitive in his own house. And I think they were trying to point out to him and make the fight personal, saying, look, you don't even have a home to go to. Well, it would appear that the battle took place on the eastern side of the Jordan, just north of the Jabbok River. And then when the Gileadites gained the upper hand, the Ephraimites decided to hightail it and run home. But the Gileadites cut them off. They made it to the Jordan before they did. Now, this is very interesting how they were asked to say the word Shibboleth, and now being able to pronounce it because of their dialect differences, they were summarily executed. Well, there's nothing inherently magical with the word Shibboleth. It's not that the word itself possessed some hidden inner meaning. From what I can tell, it looks like it means stream or flood. And I think what they probably did was tell the Ephraimites, you need to ask us permission to cross the Shibboleth. And so they would say, give me leave to cross the Shibboleth. Mm-hmm. Oh, out he goes. So apparently they just weren't able to pronounce the aspirate or the sibilant portion of that word for whatever reason, and it was over with for them. 42,000 people died. Verse 7, Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried among the cities of Gilead. All right, our ninth judge is Ibzan. We see him portrayed in verses 8 to 10. After him, now when you see that phrase after him, that's the phrase I'm pointing to again and again that occurs at the introduction of a judge that in my mind clearly indicates some kind of sequencing to the judges. Not while he was reigning, God raised up this person, but after him, meaning Jephthah's dead and we have a new guy. After him, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel. He had 30 sons, and he gave away 30 daughters in marriage and brought in 30 daughters from elsewhere for his sons. He judged Israel 7 years. Then Ibzan died and was buried in Bethlehem. Ibzan was most probably, and most commentators agree on this, not from Bethlehem of Judah, which is down here, but of Bethlehem up here in Zebulun, that he was part of the northern tribes. The scripture is completely silent on all his deeds of valor, and I'm not sure what was greater, judging Israel or arranging 60 marriages. I don't ever want to hear anybody complain about finding a mate for their children. This guy found 60 of them. How in the world could he do that? I don't have any idea. That would have been interesting in the Chronicle of Judges, find out how he found 60 spouses. Alright, our 10th judge is Elon. We see him in verse 11 here in 12. After him, Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel. So he's from the same area. He judged Israel 10 years. And Elon the Zebulunite died and was buried in Ajalon in the country of Zebulun. So Ajalon is down here from what I could tell. But I think he was probably was from up here and came down here. Many of the judges seemed to gravitate toward Ephraim in that area so that they could have a central location. But we don't have any idea what's going on here. Our 11th judge, Abdon, verses 13 to 15. After him, Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, judged Israel. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 young donkeys. He judged Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried in Pirathon in the land of Ephraim in the mountains of the Amalekites. Well, it's time for Ephraim to have a judge. Pirathon is right here in the middle of Ephraim's country on the west side there. He appears to be some sort of man of prominence to have had been the ability to outfit 70 sons and grandsons. Strangely, he is named after his city and not his tribe. I'm not sure why and what's so significant about that. But the thought is on a couple of these judges, if you'll recall, I think in Tola and such, that they had sons and they rode on donkeys, and the idea being that these were good and godly men who went out to judge Israel. So in this case, it probably wasn't Abdon himself doing all the judging, but he had his sons commissioned and grandsons who rode out there on these donkeys to also take care of business on behalf of Israel. So, well, that concludes Lesson 11. We'll take any other remaining questions you have. We're going to cover Samson. I think the schedule will be we'll do Samson over the next 2 weeks and then probably have 1 week to maybe recap the whole thing, bring it to a close. So, any questions? Oh, we have one over here.
In my version, it says 40 sons and 30 nephews.
The from what I've been able to tell, the distinction between grandson and nephew and such is often blurred in Scripture. They don't often hold the same distinctions or the importance of those distinctions as is done commonly today. Yeah. Any other thoughts?